Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and today's conversation with Linda Morgan, Chairman, Surface Transportation Board. And joining us in our conversation is another PwC partner, Dave Abel. Well, Linda, what role does the federal government play in the regulatory oversight of railroad, trucking, and the bus industries?
Well, again, as I mentioned earlier, for the freight rail industry, the regulatory scheme is pervasive in that we do touch all elements of the business of freight railroads, rates, service, restructuring, whether it be mergers, line sales, or abandonments. With respect to the trucking industry, our main focus is in the rate area, and even there, it's a limited oversight. And with respect to buses, it's principally mergers of intercity bus companies. And then with respect to pipelines, it's rate review, and with respect to non-contiguous domestic water trade, that's also rate review. Now, some would say, well, it sounds as though the freight rail industry is regulated more pervasively than some of these other modes. Why is that? Well, I think, first of all, we need to go back into history a little bit. The freight rail industry regulatory scheme has been reformed. In 1980, Congress passed the Staggers Rail Act, which I, as a staff person, actually worked on. And that law did significantly reform the regulatory scheme applicable to the freight railroads. What remains is regulation where the market is imperfect. Because you have to remember, with the freight rail industry, entry is not as easy as in other modes. To build a new rail line obviously takes time and money, unlike, say, in the trucking industry, where a trucker can go buy a truck and enter a market with really low entry costs. So there's a recognition that since entry is not as easy, that there are places where the market does not provide for the perfect competition in the marketplace. But again, the regulatory scheme is much less than it used to be. Prior to 1980, the regulation was very heavy and burdensome. And as a matter of fact, the freight rail industry was in financial decay and as a whole was about to go bankrupt. And so government stepped in and essentially peeled back the regulations. And so now what we do is focus on that small segment of the market that needs a little extra oversight from some sort of regulatory body. Now, the other thing about the freight rail industry that's very important is that we have preemption in our statute, which means that states and localities can only affect the operations of the freight rail network in a limited way, because obviously you don't want to burden interstate commerce unnecessarily. And so having a regulatory scheme in place that, in essence, preempts the field, if you will, of economic regulation ensures that the freight railroads can continue to do their business without unnecessary interference.
Linda, what's the history of the board? How did the board assume the regulatory responsibility for these modes of transportation?
Of course, you had the Interstate Commerce Commission in existence since 1887. It was the first independent regulatory body created. It oversaw railroads and then got into other modes of transportation over its history. Then, as I told you, there were some deregulatory laws passed, not only the Staggers Rail Act, but also the Motor Carrier Act of 1980, the Bus Act of, I think it was, 82, and then some more trucking reform in 94. Congress reached a point where it decided that the Interstate Commerce Commission, as an agency, was no longer serving a needed function. And so there was discussion of eliminating the agency as we knew it at that time. After some debate in Congress, it was determined that there were functions, particularly in the rail area, that needed to be continued. And so they needed to find a place for those continued functions. And they also needed to continue some sort of independent forum. The determination in Congress was made that we needed to have some sort of independent adjudicative body to handle these rail issues that needed oversight. And so they eliminated the ICC as part of the ICC Termination Act of 1995. But then as part of that, they created the Surface Transportation Board, which came into existence in 1996. the board assumed, in essence, all of the responsibilities in the freight rail area that the ICC had had. The motor carrier arena was deregulated further, and what was left to that was split between the board and the Department of Transportation, which now has safety-related truck and bus functions.
You were part of the ICC. Now you're part of the Surface Transportation Board. One went away, another was sort of born in some limited context. What were the management challenges involved in closing an organization and setting up a new one?
Well, there were actually several challenges. Some of them were internal and some of them were external. The external challenges were that while Congress had indicated that it wanted to eliminate the ICC, the law making that happen did not really pass until after the appropriations bill that was implementing what the Congress wanted to do was passed. So I had a funding bill, in essence, that told me how much in funds I would have available before I actually had the implementing law in place. So I ended up having to figure out how many people could remain with the funds that I would have available, rather than figuring out what the functions were going to be, figuring out how many people I needed to do the functions, and then figuring out how much money would be available. And it was no criticism of the process. It's just that sometimes in Congress things happen that way. And so that was the first challenge, is how to figure out how many people I would need given the money that I knew I was going to have available. The second challenge was that I closed the ICC at the same time that the Congress and the White House were in a battle over the famous government shutdown. If you recall, mm-hmm. in 1995, there was quite a battle going on about appropriations for the government in total. And so I was having to worry about the broader issues of shutting an agency down and trying to seek help on that. At the same time, I knew that my agency was also going to shut down in any event. And as you know, there are personnel requirements that you must fulfill in terms of notifying employees of when they might be terminated. And the requirements were different depending upon whether it was about shutting the agency down or about some sort of furlough associated with a government shutdown. So it was a very complex challenge. I think the third challenge, which is the internal challenge, is how do you keep your work going and how do you keep the morale of people up when they know that some will be laid off and some will not be laid off. And that was really a script that I wrote that no one else had written before me, how to keep the work going and how to keep the morale up. What I would say if I were advising somebody in that situation, first of all, be honest with your employees about what you know and what you don't know in terms of what's going to happen to them. Be very visible. Be working very hard on the pending matters so that they see you caring about what's going on in terms of the substance. And just providing the kind of honest leadership that's necessary in a difficult time like that. And I ended up actually separating employees over the Christmas holidays of that particular year, which was a very difficult process. But I'm happy to say that employees who were separated have come back to see me. And the one thing that they have said is that while we lost our job in this process, you were always fair, you were always open, you were always available, you always showed that you cared about what was happening to us in this process. So I think that's a lesson for everyone. And I've also been told by people in Congress that they appreciated the fact that the work continued to somehow get done despite the difficult situation that was presented to the board, to the ICC.
Linda, we've seen the startup of a new agency in DOT, the Transportation Security Administration, and there's been a lot of talk about it being financed by user fees.
Yes.
Now, the board is partially financed by user fees. What type of fees is it that the board collects, and how does that fit into the overall budget of the organization?
Well, first of all, we have a budget of about $17 million, and of that, $1 million comes from user fees. The fees are collected from various types of filings. For example, if someone seeks a merger authority, they file an application, and with that they file a fee. If someone complains about a rate being too high, they file a complaint and they file a fee with that. Now, this whole notion of fees came about a number of years ago. This is not unique to the board or the ICC before it. There was a move several years ago to begin to collect from the recipients of government service some sort of fee to cover the costs. And the ICC joined in that effort, if you will. But I will say that since that decision was made, there continues to be concern raised about whether in an independent adjudicative body there should be any kind of fees at all.
That's a good stopping point for a break. Come back in a few minutes as we continue our conversation about management with Linda Morgan of the Surface Transportation Board. This is the Business of Government Hour.